You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to episode 451 of our Civil War podcast. My name is Rich.
And I'm Tracy. Hello y'all, welcome to the podcast. In November 1863, Sergeant William Walker of the 3rd South Carolina Infantry took dramatic action to express a grievance shared by thousands of black troops in the Union Army. The 23-year-old former slave, as court-martial specifications later documented, quote, did unlawfully take command, end quote, of Company A and marched the troops to his commanding officer's tent.
There, he ordered them to stack arms, and when asked what this meant, replied, "We will not do our duty for $7 per month." Walker refused an order to return to duty and told his company, quote, to let their arms alone and go to their quarters.
They did, and, quote, thereby excited and joined in a general mutiny.
Walker would pay for his defiance with his life. Despite a plea that he and his comrades had, quote, only contemplated a peaceful demand for the rights and benefits that had been guaranteed them, end quote, during the second week of January 1864, a military tribunal found William Walker guilty of mutiny, and he was executed by firing squad. Sergeant Walker's case illustrates the depth of resentment felt by black soldiers who had enlisted to fight for the Union cause and for their freedom, only to find that they were to be paid less than their white comrades.
Already confronted with a combat environment in which, if captured, they might very well find themselves returned to slavery or shot out of hand, black soldiers were generally assigned the nastiest camp duties and forced to confront the reality of racism on a daily basis.
Unequal pay was one more glaring reminder of their second-rate status in the federal armies. A white enlisted man received $13 a month, and his pay included a clothing allowance of $3 to be spent at the soldier's discretion. By contrast, a black enlisted man was paid $10, but received only $7, since the remaining $3 was withheld as a clothing allowance.
The adoption of such a blatantly discriminatory policy reveals how the Lincoln administration was often scrambling to respond to military necessity while trying to balance conflicting demands from radical Republicans and peace Democrats.
At the beginning of the war, few but the most ardent abolitionists advocated for arming blacks to fight for the Union. For example, when Lincoln's first Secretary of War, Simon Cameron, was told there were 300 black volunteers ready to help defend Washington, D.C. during the first weeks of the conflict, he rejected the offer, saying that, quote, this department has no intention at present to call into the services of the government any colored soldiers.
Intentions began to shift in the wake of the federal debacle at Bull Run in the summer of 1861. By the end of that year, the New York Tribune, a leading Republican newspaper, supported the use of black troops. And in his annual report to Congress, Cameron recommended arming the contrabands flooding into Union lines.
but Lincoln forced Cameron to cut that recommendation from his report, the first of the president's many actions to rein in zealous administration officials or field commanders who were sympathetic to abolitionist aims and eager to enlist blacks. Early in 1862, for example, the administration quashed efforts to recruit black troops by Union generals in Kansas and Louisiana. And when Major General David Hunter began organizing a regiment drawn from freedmen on the Sea Islands of South Carolina in May 1862, opposition from Washington, as well as local resistance to his heavy-handed recruiting practices, forced him to abandon his effort after 3 months.
Shortly thereafter, though, Lincoln had a change of heart. In mid-August, he replaced Hunter with abolitionist Brigadier General Rufus Saxton. On August 25, 1862, Secretary of War Edwin Stanton authorized Saxton to recruit 5,000 volunteers at Port Royal, South Carolina, to form the first federally sanctioned black regiments.
Stanton's action was in response to twin pieces of legislation passed a month earlier. The Second Confiscation Act, which empowered the president to employ contrabands in the suppression of the rebellion, quote, in such manner as he may judge best, end quote, and the Militia Act, authorizing the enrollment of blacks for, quote, any military or naval service for which they may be found competent.
In issuing his August order, Stanton dictated that the volunteers were, quote, to be entitled to and receive the same pay and rations as are allowed by law to volunteers in the service.
Unfortunately, however, the usually meticulous Stanton had made a mistake. It was an error that would go unnoticed for 9 months and would result in anger and resentment among thousands of the Army's black recruits.
In accordance with the War Department policy that only white officers could command black troops, Rufus Saxton turned to an old friend, Massachusetts abolitionist Thomas Wentworth Higginson, to lead the first new regiment.
Over the following months, Saxton and Higginson thoroughly drilled the recruits. Higginson embraced his mission with characteristic enthusiasm and a somewhat exaggerated sense of larger purpose, writing in his journal, quote, the first man who organizes and commands a successful black regiment will perform the most important service in the history of the war. Then, after his troops had performed admirably in a series of small engagements, he suggested that, quote, the fate of the whole movement for colored soldiers rested on the behavior of this one regiment.
By the time Higginson wrote those words in May 1863, the quote-unquote movement for colored soldiers was well underway. On New Year's Day, the Emancipation Proclamation had affirmed that persons previously held as slaves, quote, will be received into the armed service of the United States.
Changes in public opinion, particularly the idea that emancipation was a military necessity, led to a growing acceptance of the thought of black troops. War correspondent Whitelaw Reed, writing in the Cincinnati Gazette, declared, quote, the day for raising a panic over Negro enlistment is over, and it has passed as an accepted fact into the history of the war.
White Union soldiers also seemed increasingly open to accepting black comrades in arms. In the spring of 1863, an Illinois soldier wrote, quote, a year ago last January, I didn't like to hear anything of emancipation. Last fall, I accepted confiscation of rebels' Negroes quietly. In January, I took to emancipation readily, and now am becoming so colorblind that I can't see why they will not make soldiers.
I'm Jane Perlez. longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
The 1860 census had revealed that there were about 100,000 free black men and more than 500,000 male slaves of military age in the United States. While many of the latter remained behind Confederate lines, younger men who had escaped to freedom made up an unusually high percentage of the contraband population. Abraham Lincoln clearly saw the value of these potential soldiers. In a March 1863 letter, he wrote, "The colored population is the greatest available and yet unavailed of force for restoring the Union. The bare sight of 50,000 armed and drilled black soldiers on the banks of the Mississippi would end the rebellion at once. And who doubts that we can present that sight if we but take hold in earnest?"
The Lincoln administration finally took hold in earnest in late May 1863 when Stanton created the Bureau of Colored Troops. The Bureau's head, Major Charles Foster, devised different regional recruiting strategies for filling the ranks of the U.S. colored troops.
In New England and the Middle Atlantic, Foster delegated the authority to enlist black troops to state governments and to public and private organizations such as the Union League in Philadelphia. Resistance among state officials in the Midwest limited recruiting efforts in that region, while recruiters in former rebel territory along the South Atlantic coast and in the Mississippi River Valley often relied on impressment. In those areas of the Confederacy controlled by Union forces and in the border states, the military itself generally oversaw recruiting, drawing heavily from contraband camps.
One soldier from Maryland noted, quote, "Recruits were taken wherever found. The laborer in the field would throw down his hoe or quit his plow and march away with the guard, leaving his late owner looking after him in speechless amazement."
Robert Cowden, a recruiter in Memphis, Tennessee, described the transformation undergone by new recruits. Quote, "The average plantation Negro was a hard-looking specimen in a close-fitting wool shirt and pantaloons of homespun material. The first pass made at him was with a pair of shears. The next was to strip him of his filthy rags and burn them and scour him thoroughly with soap and water. A clean new suit of army blue was now put on him, together with a full suite of military accoutrements, and a gun was placed in his hand, and lo, he was completely metamorphosed."
When establishing the Bureau of Colored Troops, Stanton had asked the War Department's solicitor, William Whiting, to review the question of the pay rate for black soldiers. Whiting came back with a ruling that the only legislation in effect, the 1862 Militia Act, clearly stated that, quote, "Persons of African descent who under this law shall be employed shall receive $10 per month, $3 of which monthly pay may be in clothing."
And so, with that, Stanton's earlier promise of equal pay, the basis on which many blacks had enlisted, that promise would now have to be broken. Back when the Militia Act was adopted in July 1862, several rationales were used to justify the pay differential. For example, skeptical that blacks would make good combat troops, Lincoln and others in his administration and Congress argued that African-American recruits would mainly be assigned to garrison rather than frontline duty.
Others, including the New York World's editorial writers, argued that pay equity would inflame the prejudices of white troops. Quote, to claim that the indolent, servile Negro is the equal in courage, enterprise, and fire of the foremost race in all the world is libel. It is unjust in every way to the white soldier to put him on a level with the black.
However, by the middle of 1863, these arguments carried less weight. Colonel Higginson's 1st South Carolina had taken part in a number of small but successful actions along the southern Atlantic coast. In the West, recently organized United States Colored Troops, or USCT units, fought with distinction during the early stages of the siege of Port Hudson and at the Battle of Milliken's Bend on June 7th. Assistant Secretary of War Charles Dana reported to Stanton, quote, having seen how they could fight, many were won over to arming them for the Union.
Unfortunately, Stanton had already moved to align War Department policy with the 1862 Militia Act. On June 4th, he issued a directive that confirmed a black enlisted man would be paid just $10 and would receive only $7 since the remaining $3 would be withheld as a clothing allowance.
The policy of paying black troops less than their white counterparts pleased no one. Those it was meant to appease saw it for the sop that it was, while black soldiers and their white supporters resented it. When Ohio Governor David Todd questioned the War Department about the policy, Stanton suggested that, as far as any additional pay, quote, colored troops must trust to state contributions and the justice of Congress.
However, when Governor John Andrews sought to make up the difference in pay for the 54th and 55th Massachusetts regiments from state funds, a regimental spokesman condemned the offer, saying acceptance of it would lead the public to mistakenly assume they were, quote, holding out for money and not principle, that we sink our manhood in consideration for a few more dollars.
For many, the pay differential represented real hardship. A correspondent to the Christian Recorder wrote, when I was at home, I could make a living for my wife and my two little ones, but now that I am a soldier, they must do the best they can or starve.
Another soldier serving in the 8th USCT wrote that his, quote, wife and three little children at home are freezing and starving to death. She writes to me for aid, but I have nothing to send her.
The white officers shared their troops' dismay. Unequal pay, wrote Colonel Higginson, quote, has inflicted untold suffering, has impaired discipline, has relaxed loyalty, and has begun to implant a feeling of sullen distrust.
Black troops were not alone in harboring feelings of, quote unquote, sullen distrust. On August 1, 1863, Frederick Douglass, who had two sons serving in the 54th Massachusetts, announced that he would no longer recruit troops for the Union Army. He said, when I plead for recruits, I want to do it with all my heart. I cannot do that now.
George Stearns, a wealthy businessman deeply involved in the recruitment effort, was reluctant to lose one of his most effective recruiters, and so he urged Douglass to take his concerns directly to the president. On August 10th, Frederick Douglass did just that.
Arriving in Washington after a long train ride from his home in Rochester, New York, Douglass set out on foot for the White House. Lacking an appointment, he could not be sure Abraham Lincoln would even see him. However, a chance encounter with Samuel Pomeroy, a radical Republican whom Douglas knew well, led to an offer by the Kansas senator to help facilitate the meeting.
After a brief huddle in the War Department with Secretary of War Stanton, who assured the two men that he favored equal pay, Pomeroy and Douglas proceeded to the White House. There, to Frederick Douglass's considerable surprise, the president not only received him almost straight away, but although the two men had never met, Lincoln's frank and earnest manner immediately put him at ease. Nevertheless, Abraham Lincoln was well aware that Douglass was a frequent court critic of his wartime policies as well as his support for colonization, so it was not surprising that the president became somewhat defensive when Douglass raised his primary concern, the pay inequity between white and black soldiers.
According to Douglass, Lincoln pointed out that since black troops, quote, had larger motives for being soldiers than white men, end quote, that meant, in his view, they, quote, ought to be willing to enter the service upon any condition.
The president argued that since the employment of black soldiers was still subject to popular prejudice in the North, the fact that they received lower pay was, at present, a, quote, necessary concession to smooth the way, end quote. But he assured Douglass that it would ultimately be corrected.
Of his meeting with Lincoln, Frederick Douglass wrote that while he was, quote, not entirely satisfied with his views, end quote, nonetheless, he, quote, was so well satisfied with the man that I determined to go on with the recruiting.
Frederick Douglass's meeting with the president led to no immediate change in War Department policy, but in Edwin Stanton's year-end report, the Secretary of War did urge Congress to correct the pay differential. It wasn't until the following June of 1864, that Congress took the first step toward equalizing pay. Retroactive to January 1st, all black troops were to be paid the same amount as their white counterparts. In addition, any member of the USCT who could attest that he had been a free man as of April 19, 1861, could collect back pay for 1862 and 1863.
Such requests for back pay were to be accompanied by an oath, which led one creative officer to contrive a pledge wherein claimants solemnly swore that they, quote, owed no man unrequited labor on or before the 19th day of April, 1861.
While such a vow was plausible for a recruit from the northern states, it would have been patently false for the vast majority of the black soldiers, 75% of whom were recently freed slaves from the border states and from federally controlled portions of the Confederacy. And so the issue continued to fester. Not until March 3, 1865, did Congress pass legislation granting full retroactive pay to all black troops.
Why did it take so long to equalize the pay of black and white soldiers? After all, either Abraham Lincoln or Edwin Stanton might have reversed or simply chosen to ignore the ruling of the War Department's solicitor in the spring of 1863.
They had shown little reluctance, when they thought it necessary, to override other, more well-established policies or suspend vital constitutional rights. And for a contemporaneous example of the negligible impact of equal pay for black and white troops, they needed look no further than the Union Navy, in which about 20% of the 101,000 men who served were black and received the same pay as their shipmates.
In April 1864, Attorney General Edward Bates argued that the president had a quote-unquote, constitutional obligation to rectify the pay inequity, but Lincoln nevertheless chose to leave the issue in the hands of Congress.
Lincoln's rationale for failing to act sooner might perhaps be defined from his August 1863 meeting with Frederick Douglass. The president believed, quote, blacks had larger motives for being soldiers than white men, end quote. Had Douglass himself not argued that for black men who fought for the Union, quote, there is no power on earth that can deny the right to citizenship.
So Lincoln calculated that their eagerness to fight a war that would guarantee their freedom and lead to citizenship was likely to override any number of indignities suffered by black soldiers, including unequal pay.
In the end, Lincoln's pragmatic acceptance of the necessary concession of unequal pay proved to be a sound political calculation, but it came at no small price to thousands of black soldiers and their families who suffered real hardship because of it. And then, of course, there was Sergeant William Walker, who protested the injustice of the policy and paid for it with his life after being tried by court-martial in January 1864. Massachusetts Governor John Andrew, who was appalled by the entire affair, wrote to President Lincoln, pointing out, quote, the government which found no law to pay him except as a contraband, nevertheless found law enough to shoot him as a soldier.
That means it's time for this episode's book recommendation, and our recommendation this time is Black Soldiers in Blue, African American Troops in the Civil War Era, edited by John David Smith.
This book contains 14 essays that look at the military, political, and social significance of black soldiers fighting for the Union cause. As we've said, and you guys know by now, by war's end, 180,000 black soldiers had served or were serving in the federal armies.
Don't forget you can find a list of all of our book recommendations if you head over to the podcast website, which is www.civilwarpodcast.org.
Also at the website, you can find information on joining the Strawfoot Brigade over on Patreon and supporting the podcast in that way, just like Monty, Liz, Frank A., and Gomer did this past week.
We also want to say thank you to Shakar B. for his donation. And thanks to all of you for listening to this episode of the podcast. Rich and I do hope that you'll join us again next time, but until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.